George Herbert Walker Bush's life after the presidency defies the typical narrative of a defeated incumbent. Just hours before his death in November 2018, while I sat holding his hand, he opened his eyes and asked, "Are you okay?" His final words perfectly capturing his lifelong concern for others. This moment epitomizes the man celebrated by world leaders and ordinary citizens alike, whose post-presidential journey became as impactful as his time in office. After leaving the White House in 1993 with a devastating electoral defeat, despite once enjoying a 91% approval rating, Bush rebuilt his life through determination, courage, and service. Skydiving at 90, despite Parkinson's confining him to a wheelchair, partnering with Bill Clinton on disaster relief, and living his mantra that any definition of a successful life must include serving others. His story reminds us that our greatest contributions often come when the spotlight dims, when character, rather than power, defines our actions. Losing the presidency devastated George H.W. Bush. The transition from being the world's most powerful person to a private citizen overnight was jarring and disorienting. During a Caribbean cruise shortly after leaving office, Bush wrote a memo outlining his priorities: making enough money for Barbara's security, building his presidential library, spending time with grandchildren, helping others, and staying physically active. He also listed things to avoid: interfering with President Clinton, trying to be a kingmaker, cheapening the presidency, or attempting to influence how history would treat him. That first year proved emotionally challenging. At one particularly low point, Bush lamented, "I lost the election, my mother died, my dog died, and my boat crashed." The loss of routine, purpose, and the trappings of power hit hard. Years later, he would write 10 Rules for Former Presidents, advising to get out of Washington quickly, avoid criticizing successors, be kind to autograph seekers, stay away from the limelight, and count one's blessings. By 1994, however, Bush had emerged from his post-presidency malaise with remarkable energy. When his chief of staff, Rose Zamaria, retired, he asked me to temporarily fill the role despite my protests about lacking experience. The temporary arrangement became permanent, though we never formally discussed it. Bush threw himself into an astonishing schedule, giving 111 speeches, campaigning for 48 candidates, visiting 22 foreign countries, and half the states in just 1 year. His daily affairs included fielding calls from political leaders about Bosnia, scheduling meetings with foreign dignitaries, planning book work with General Scowcroft, and managing personal commitments. Though initially reluctant to re-enter politics, Bush found joy in fundraising for others, especially his sons George W. and Jeb, who were running for governors of Texas and Florida, respectively. Their campaigns helped heal his wounds from losing the presidency, as he realized his defeat had actually opened doors for his sons' political careers, a silver lining he cherished. When George W. Bush was sworn in as the 43rd president in January 2001, it created both a heartwarming family moment and a practical problem. America suddenly had two President George Bushes. While this had happened only once before with John and John Quincy Adams, modern media made this far more complicated. The solution came from Congressman John Dingell at the annual Alfalfa Club dinner, who suggested calling the father 41 and the son 43, based on their presidential sequence numbers. President Bush embraced this nickname enthusiastically, with 41 appearing on everything from T-shirts to golf balls. Bush's favorite moment during his son's inauguration weekend wasn't the oath-taking ceremony, but rather when, while soaking in a White House bathtub that evening, he received word that the president would like for him to join him in the Oval Office. Hurrying downstairs, despite his achy 76-year-old body, he was moved to tears seeing his son at the presidential desk already signing papers. The Bushes maintained their normal family dynamics despite their son's new role. When the president put his feet on his mother's coffee table during a visit to Walker's Point, Barbara Bush promptly told him to remove them, reminding him that she was still his mother, regardless of his title. The relationship between the two President Bushes was complex but deeply loving. When General Scowcroft published his op-ed against the Iraq invasion, he had given Bush 41 advance notice as a courtesy. While the younger Bush was understandably unhappy about this public disagreement, I became his designated ventee. During these venting sessions, I held the phone at arm's length, loudly enough that Andy Card later told me the entire West Wing heard what the president said. Despite these occasional tensions, their family bond remained paramount. When Barbara Bush experienced concerning medical symptoms, George W. called from the Oval Office insisting, "I might be president, but I am George and Barbara Bush's son first." The elder Bush's love was equally profound, as revealed in a 2003 letter where he wrote about his son's leadership. "I shamefully choked up, the tears running down my aging cheeks. A visible manifestation of a father's concern, a father's love." Despite no longer being president, George H.W. Bush maintained an incredibly active international travel schedule after leaving office. His global reputation remained extraordinarily high, with world leaders eagerly meeting him wherever he traveled. As his former aide Michael Dannenhauer noted, President Bush was treated as if he was still a head of state, with leaders seemingly unable to believe he had lost the 1992 election. Emperor Akihito of Japan rearranged his schedule to see Bush on short notice, and at Yitzhak Rabin's funeral, numerous heads of state sought private meetings with him. Bush received the highest national honors from 14 different countries, including knighthood from Queen Elizabeth, prompting Barbara Bush's teasing note, "Fix it yourself, Sir George." His travels weren't without danger. Saddam Hussein once plotted to assassinate him in Kuwait, and a harrowing journey through terrorist territory to meet Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri required Syrian military protection. Bush's meetings with world leaders typically followed a pattern of pleasantries, family updates, and substantive discussions of current events where his advice was often sought. He remained discreet about these conversations, occasionally briefing only James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and sometimes his son when he was president. His CIA background remained evident. During a meeting with Russian President Boris Yeltsin, Bush instructed aide Giancarlo Parasuti to document every detail, later revealing, "Our briefers back home will be very interested in every detail of that meeting." Bush took his international duties seriously, even in retirement. In 2006, when appointed UN Special Envoy for the Southeast Asian Earthquake Relief, he insisted on visiting Pakistan despite security concerns. Their flight path took them over Afghanistan and Iran, requiring bulletproof vests and helicopter transportation with machine gun-wielding security forces flying zigzag patterns over Islamabad. Bush visited refugee camps filled with earthquake victims living in tents, an experience he found deeply humbling. Bush also represented the United States officially at several international events, including presidential inaugurations in Mexico and Portugal, the reopening of the American Embassy in Berlin, and as head of the U.S. delegation to the 2004 Athens Olympics. As Brian Mulroney later eulogized, "When George Bush was President of the United States of America, every single head of government in the world knew they were dealing with a true gentleman, a genuine leader, one who was distinguished, resolute, and brave." The unlikely friendship between Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton became one of America's great political mysteries. Their bond began forming at the dedication of the Clinton Presidential Library in 2004, where Bush delivered a gracious, self-deprecating speech, acknowledging Clinton as one of the most gifted American political figures in modern times. Just weeks later, following the devastating Indian Ocean tsunami that killed 228,000 people, President George W. Bush asked his father and Clinton to lead a private sector fundraising effort for the disaster. The two readily agreed, appearing in public service announcements and eventually traveling together to the affected region. What began as a diplomatic mission transformed two political opponents into genuine friends. With the $12 million donated directly to their relief effort, Bush and Clinton worked with American embassies, USAI, and nonprofits to finance fishing boats in Thailand, schools and houses in Indonesia, playgrounds and a pediatric hospital wing in Sri Lanka, and houses in India and the Maldives. Everywhere they went, they were treated like rock stars, with locals expressing disbelief that anyone had come to help. As Houston Chronicle reporter Tony Fremantle observed, their trip demonstrated what America can do for a world in crisis if political differences can be put aside and allow friendship and compromise to guide us. Their friendship deepened during their April trip to Pope John Paul II's funeral, where they were the only former presidents attending. While the sitting president held bilateral meetings, Bush and Clinton enjoyed dinners with old friends. After paying respects at St. Peter's, they found themselves momentarily stranded in the square when their motorcade wasn't immediately visible. While aides panicked, the two presidents calmly chatted and even posed for photos with surprised members of an Iranian delegation who had just arrived. When Hurricane Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast, the presidents established the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund, raising $130.6 million. They visited evacuees in Houston, hugging, crying, and praying with survivors. They allocated $30 million to help colleges reopen, $25 million to churches, and $40 million to governors of affected states. With the remaining funds, each president directed $40 million according to his own philosophy. Bush preferring large-scale projects like $5 million for rebuilding libraries, while Clinton funded numerous smaller initiatives like new choir robes for a New Orleans church. Their complementary approaches created a perfect partnership addressing both major infrastructure and community needs. Clinton visited Bush in Maine every summer, though he never shared Bush's enthusiasm for fast boat rides. After Barbara Bush died in April 2018, Clinton came for a long lunch, telling stories while Bush listened and smiled. Walking to his car afterward, Clinton broke down, making me promise to call him for one last visit when the end was near, a promise unintentionally broken, as they never saw each other again. At Bush's funeral, Clinton collapsed sobbing into my arms, followed by Hillary and Chelsea. They had indeed come a long way since 1992. President Bush excelled at small acts of kindness, always thinking of others even in his final days. Whether offering rides home after events, sometimes to the dismay of his staff, inviting countless guests to stay at his homes, or performing random acts of generosity, Bush lived his values through daily actions rather than grand gestures. Bush's generosity manifested in countless ways. He once gave his driver's license to a collector in Oman, writing a memo to save the number in case he needed it later. He habitually offered rides to people after events, regardless of who they were, from reporters to General Colin Powell, creating logistical challenges for his staff. At the 2004 Republican convention, I finally arranged for a bus to accommodate his spontaneous invitations. Similarly, Bush constantly invited people to stay at his homes, particularly in Kennebunkport, where they hosted over 100 overnight guests each summer season. In 2001, at an Amy Grant and Vince Gill Christmas concert, Bush spontaneously raised his hand to sponsor a child through Compassion International. For 3 years, he exchanged letters with Timothy from the Philippines, signing as George Walker without revealing his identity. In his first letter, he wrote, "I am an old man, 77 years old, but I love kids, and though we have not met, I love you already." Though he once mentioned he got to go to the White House once in a while, Timothy only learned his pen pal's true identity after graduating from the program. After the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster in 2003, Bush felt words weren't enough. He and Barbara visited NASA without press coverage, which shocked officials accustomed to publicity-seeking VIPs. They worked through all the mission control rooms, spoke with astronauts on the International Space Station, and personally comforted engineers investigating the tragedy. Bush only cried once during the visit, but his genuine emotion meant a great deal to the NASA staff. Bush was deeply disturbed by prejudice of any kind, often lamenting that neither he nor I knew what discrimination felt like. After 9/11, he asked me to find a Muslim event he could attend to counter growing anti-Muslim sentiment. Years later, when concerned about rising anti-Semitism, he broke his no awards policy to accept a Jewish honor on one condition: the ceremony must be held in a synagogue with press present. President Bush's passionate belief that any definition of a successful life must include serving others led him to establish Points of Light, an organization encouraging worldwide volunteerism. First mentioning 1,000 Points of Light in his 1988 convention speech, despite campaign advisor skepticism, Bush created the White House Office of National Service before taking office and later established the Points of Light Foundation. He instituted the Daily Point of Light Award, personally signing congratulatory letters to recipients until his death. Today, Points of Light operates in 37 countries, continuing Bush's vision that every person can serve others. President Bush's frequent utterance of "I have an idea" became both the joy and occasional bane of my 25-year career as his chief of staff. His constant flow of ideas, particularly surprise events, made our lives full and vibrant, though sometimes overwhelmingly so. I even joke that my least favorite sound was President Bush when he says, "Gene, I have an idea." Yet these ideas formed the rich tapestry of Bush's post-presidential life and kept everyone around him engaged in meaningful work. President Bush loved organizing leadership forums at his presidential library, inviting eclectic groups of friends to speak with Aggie students. These popular events often featured seemingly disconnected panels, like one with Tom Selleck, Diane Sawyer, astronaut Stephen Lindsay, and hotelier Steve Wynn. Another focused on successful women, bringing together tennis player Chris Everett, actress Terry Hatcher, astronaut Eileen Collins, and White House counsel Harriet Mears. Bush's commitment to nonpartisanship meant speakers from across the political spectrum appeared at the library, from Nancy Pelosi to Ted Kennedy to John McCain. One spring day when Mrs. Bush was traveling, President Bush spontaneously decided to boost attendance at an Astros game. Instead of accepting owner Drayton McLean's usual invitation to sit behind home plate, Bush gathered about 50 staff members, Secret Service agents and their families, and even CBS sportscaster Jim Nance and his daughter to sit in the upper-level left field. He gave his credit card to the nearest concession stand for everyone to enjoy whatever they wanted. His plan to surprise McLean was foiled when the scoreboard camera found them first, and a visiting Ugandan children's choir began singing to the former president. President Bush's two biggest post-presidency ideas were jumping out of airplanes and returning to Chichijima, where he'd been shot down during World War II. In early 1997, at age 72, Bush decided he needed a do-over of his first parachute jump, which occurred when his plane was hit over Chichijima in 1944. Despite initial fears, Bush completed the jump successfully, describing the sensation as marvelous, floating gently toward Earth at peace. Far from a one-time event, Bush would jump six more times, including on his 90th birthday, despite Barbara's fury and his being wheelchair-bound. In June 2002, Bush returned to Chichijima, the remote Japanese island where he'd been shot down in 1944. The group took a small boat to the spot where Bush's plane had crashed. He threw wreaths into the water to honor his lost crew members and spent time alone in a life raft, floating where he had drifted for 3 hours as a young pilot. Bush later confided to me that the journey gave him closure, though he remained haunted by thoughts of those he might have killed during his bombing missions. The experience of being shot down had made Bush fearless throughout his life, whether flying through thunderstorms or navigating dangerous seas at Walker's Point. Working for President Bush taught me invaluable life lessons. Think big, think of others, make a difference, don't be afraid to get in the ring, and live with joy. But on deeper reflection, I learned more profound lessons. Be open to new ideas, don't fear changing your mind or admitting mistakes, don't judge, and don't hold grudges. Bush was a consummate big thinker who constantly surprised me. When I considered becoming a newspaper columnist, he suggested I buy a newspaper instead. When his aide Evan Sisley mentioned applying to medical school, Bush called it an excellent resume builder. Throughout his life, Bush made unexpected choices, moving to West Texas after Yale instead of Wall Street, requesting China as his ambassadorial post rather than London or Paris, and attending Emperor Hirohito's funeral despite criticism. Bush had an insatiable fascination with gadgets and new technology. In summer 2003, he surprised me by buying a potato gun, which he and his brother Bucky tested by shooting potatoes across the bay toward tourists. Despite their age, both George and Barbara Bush eagerly embraced new technology: computers, cell phones, iPads, digital cameras, and the internet, often learning faster than I did. President Bush exemplified the willingness to evolve in his thinking, particularly regarding same-sex marriage. In 2004, he confessed in an email to Mary Madeline that the concept confused him, writing he was getting old at just about the right time, as his traditional beliefs seemed headed for the dustbins of history. Yet his journey toward acceptance began earlier. When his aide Michael Dannenhauer nervously came out as gay in 1998, Bush immediately assured him, "I love you, nothing would ever change that, you are family." By 2013, Bush had fully embraced same-sex marriage, attending the wedding of Bonnie Clement and Helen Thorgelson in Kennebunkport. Unlike his wife Barbara, who struggled with forgiving those who criticized her family, President Bush rarely held grudges. I believe he possibly went to his grave disliking only three people: Saddam Hussein, Ross Perot, and Dan Rather. His most famous reconciliation was with Bill Clinton, but his friendship with Geraldine Ferrara was equally remarkable. Despite their contentious 1984 vice presidential debate, where Ferraro accused Bush of being condescending and patronizing, and despite Barbara Bush's infamous comment about the Ferraro's $4 million that rhymes with rich, the political rivals developed a genuine friendship. President Bush's unwavering commitment to honesty is illustrated through the story of his World War II service revolver. After being rescued by the submarine USS Finback, Bush had given his .38-caliber Smith & Wesson to Lieutenant Albert Brostrom as thanks for sharing a bunk. Decades later, Brostrom's son Ron found the gun hidden beneath attic floorboards and arranged to return it to Bush. When I suggested proceeding with the ceremony, even if he wasn't certain it was his gun since no one would know the difference, Bush firmly stated, "I would know." This unwavering commitment to truth, even when no one would have known otherwise, exemplified Bush's character in an age increasingly filled with lies, made-up stories, and fake news. President Bush had extraordinary energy even in his later years, but gradually slowed after hip replacements, back surgery, and a 2010 diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. This progressively limited his mobility, requiring a cane, scooter, and finally a wheelchair. Though initially disappointed he wouldn't finish life at full throttle and experiencing a period of depression, he eventually accepted his new normal with characteristic grace and humor. He continued public appearances, including throwing out first pitches at Astros games, once memorably waving the catcher closer until finally handing him the ball. Despite his physical limitations, he remained mentally sharp, though quieter, sometimes struggling to formulate words but understanding everything said to him. The Bushes' deep connection only grew more touching with age. From President Bush waiting at the White House diplomatic entrance in old clothes and a cowboy hat for his bride to return from trips, to Mrs. Bush pinching her cheeks for color when hearing his voice, their devotion was constant. When I suggested separate bedrooms due to snoring, Bush was appalled. "I have to be able to reach out during the night and touch her and make sure she is there." After Barbara Bush died in April 2018, President Bush surprised everyone by rallying through his grief. He attended her funeral, hosted a brunch for dignitaries, including former presidents, and even went for Tex-Mex with family the night after burying his wife. The next day, he nearly died from sepsis, with his aide Evan giving him perhaps an hour to live without immediate intervention. The family unanimously voted for life-saving measures, and Bush recovered enough to spend one final summer at Walker's Point, his first summer there without Barbara since 1945. A service dog named Sully joined the household, bringing joy as he followed Bush everywhere and played with the family dogs. Despite these bright moments, sadness hung over Walker's Point. As summer ended, when Evan and I asked where he wanted to die, Bush cut to the chase. "Let's go home. Let's go to Houston." Secretary Baker's friendship with President Bush deepened in their final years together. On November 30, 2018, the day Bush died, Baker visited twice. During his first visit, when Bush asked where they were going, Baker replied, "You are going to heaven." "That's where I want to go," Bush answered. That night, Baker was rubbing his friend's feet when Bush passed away, surrounded by family members and close staff. Bush's last words were spoken to his oldest son, "I love you too." Though President Bush hated the word legacy almost as much as he hated broccoli, his transformation from defeated incumbent in 1992 to one of the most revered men in the world 26 years later speaks for itself. As John Meacham eulogized, Bush was America's last great soldier statesman and a 20th century founding father who governed with virtues resembling Washington, Adams, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower, men who believed in causes larger than themselves. Despite his imperfections and occasional verbal stumbles, Bush lived by his code. Tell the truth. Don't blame people. Be strong. Do your best. Try hard. Forgive. Stay the course. Perhaps Bush's own advice, given in 2003 when asked about the greatest challenge he had overcome, best encapsulates his approach to life. Don't get down when life takes a bad turn. Don't blame others for setbacks. Give credit to others when things go well. Listen more than you talk. Don't brag about yourself. Help friends in need. Don't be an overbearing big shot. Be kind and thankful as you succeed. Don't be afraid to show emotion when a friend is hurting. Say your prayers. These principles form the foundation of how Bush lived his life. A life that, even after the presidency, demonstrated how much good one person can do when guided by service, humility, and an unwavering moral compass.